and welcome to The Upgrade, the podcast from the team at Lifehacker, where we help you improve your life one week at a time. I'm Alice Bradley, editor-in-chief of Lifehacker, and today I'm joined by our new deputy editor, Jordan Calhoun. Hi, Jordan.
How's it going, Alice?
It's going well. Jordan, today we're tackling a topic that has been requested by our listeners numerous times, and that is becoming a better reader. More specifically, how to improve on our reading habits, finding the right books, and, you know, all that good stuff.
I absolutely need that. You know what I need is a book therapist, a literary therapist.
Yeah.
To help me emotionally be acceptant of who I am as a reader. Because better reader, that adds so much pressure.
Yeah.
So maybe the person who can help us with that today is our guest, Margaret H. Willison. Margaret is a librarian by day, but she's better known as a regular NPR personality. She serves as one of Pop Culture Happy Hour's fourth chairs, one third of the podcast Appointment Television, and one half of Two Bossy Dames.
What I think we as adults should work on is not quantity, and we should relax a little bit about quality as externally defined by organizations of prestige conference. And what instead we should be focusing on is quality of experience.
After our chat with Margaret, we'll hear from librarian Nancy Pearl, who'll tell us how to find books we'll love.
The first thing that you have to do is identify what it was about the book that you really enjoyed. And this is identifying not what the book is about, but what it was about the book that you liked.
In addition to being a librarian, Nancy is the author of the novel George and Lizzie and a frequent guest on NPR's Morning Edition. She also has a monthly TV show on Seattle Television called Book Lust with Nancy Pearl. So, Jordan, I think it's safe to say we're both pretty avid readers. If I know you as well as I definitely do.
But there's always that comparison, I feel, for being a reader. Do you ever feel that you're reading enough compared to the people who you know in your circles?
Well, my thing is I actually read a lot, but I don't retain anything that I've read, which seems like, what's the point? But to me also, I just get entertained again if I have to read the book again.
The point is the accomplishment, Alice. So you're the person who I'm comparing myself to. You'll read 100 books and you won't retain any of it, but I'll still look at you with envy.
I'll retain like 30%, maybe. I'll have like random scenes in my head from a book, but I'll be like, I don't know what it's about. But there is this one scene with a dog that
and
is
I'm
just...
on the other end of the spectrum. I can remember pretty well everything that I read, but I'm also a slow reader who takes my time, and it really conflicts with the volume that I'd like to read in a given week or a given month.
You know, I think your way is probably better because I just feel like I can't slow down. I try to slow down my reading so I could remember more of it. And it just, my brain is like, nope, we're going to rush through this.
Is it the like time you read? Fire. Are you a morning reader or evening reader?
An evening reader. I do start to fall asleep when I'm reading a book too.
That's my problem. Yeah. I fall asleep, and that's the only time that I have to reread anything is I'll always forget the last 5 pages if I'm reading at night.
Yeah. I just have to go back and like reread the next day.
Yeah.
It's like a little recap.
Previously on bedtime reading.
Exactly. You know, I think one thing I've noticed about the pandemic is that people I know are not able to read as much as they were. I think it's like, because we have more time, right? We all have more time because we're home constantly. But people are having a hard time focusing on books right now because they feel like they should be on social media constantly, just doom scrolling.
Doom scrolling definitely takes over my reading time. I found it to be effective to alternate between the two. I will read a chapter and reward myself with what terrible news is going on this week.
That's a terrible reward. That's really bad.
You just need the satisfaction of knowing that we're all doing poorly.
Just checking. Everyone's still doing badly?
Everyone's still doing
badly.
Yep, still good. And we're good.
Yeah. Well, I can't wait to talk to Margaret about this stuff because she's super fascinating, and I bet it's going to be a fun conversation.
I can't wait.
So, Margaret, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for asking me.
Of course. We've got more requests for this episode than any other one, and a lot of people writing to us asking with help becoming a better reader. And I would love to start us off by just discussing what that even means, because, I mean, they clearly are able to read, but they want to be a better reader. And what defines a better reader?
Well, I think that the way a lot of people define it is part of the reason why they find it very hard to become one. So I think as adults, we tend to measure it by how many books am I reading, right? And we also tend to focus on how prestigious are they? How serious are they? And because reading of sort of all of the consumption patterns is, I think, the one for adults most mired in prestige pursuit, that those two things work at odds to one another, right? Because if you're reading literary fiction or even just like heavy nonfiction, it can be very hard to get a strong enough grasp on a narrative thread that you're really propelled through the material because they're not structured to be read that way. And for most adults, you know, obviously in the before times, a lot of reading was happening on commutes. In the now times, who knows when we're doing anything or how much of it. But in a commute on the T, or I guess the subway, depending on what you colloquially refer to public transportation as, you have 15, 20, 25 minutes of uninterrupted time. And if you're going through really dense, elusive paragraphs of beautiful imagistic writing, it can be hard to build the momentum you need to have to really plow through a book. And so if you've set yourself up and you're saying, well, I'm going to read this book because I heard the author interviewed on Fresh Air. It sounded like they made some really trenchant observations. And this is an important one for me. And then you are also saying, and I'm going to read 25 books this year. I'm going to read 2 books a month. You know, very quickly into the year, you might have a hard time building momentum with that literary fiction, and you're already behind the schedule. And then you just feel like you're failing on two fronts. You feel like I'm not nailing it with this prestigious reading, and I'm not doing it anywhere near as fast as I want to. And then it's very easy to get discouraged. So my recommendations are, let's come up with a different understanding of what being a good reader looks like as an adult. And I just talked for a long time, so I don't know if you guys want to get a word in edgewise or whatever.
I'm fascinated. No, I mean, I would love to find out like how you can become a better reader, how you would define that.
So I think being a good reader, and it should be clear, I mean, I'm on this podcast because I'm a book reviewer and I'm publicly, like I'm a librarian, I'm known on the internet to be a book person. But I do not have an easy time reading as much as I would like to. I listen to a lot of music, a lot of podcasts. I watch TV. I read so much internet, just like such an ill-advised volume of internet. And so finding time for fiction or nonfiction reading, that's still something that I have to do consciously as well. Just wanted to establish that up front. And what I think we as adults should work on is not quantity, and we should relax a little bit about quality as externally defined by organizations of prestige conference. And what instead we should be focusing on is quality of experience. And I think a lot of people who would like to be better readers are people who were huge readers when they were kids. I don't want to say all of them. It may be that this is something that's never been a habit in your life that you're trying to build now. But I think for a lot of us, it's like trying to get back to Eden, to that Edenic space where you would just sit down with a book and be dead to the world for hours on end. And so that's what I want to help people get back to is books that make you into a selfish consumer, right? Books where you are just incredibly propelled to keep going, where you can fall into this fictional space or this non-fictional space and just be wholly absorbed the same way you were when you were 10 and like the first book that you really clicked with as a independent reader came across your stoop.
I never fall into the problem of prestige chasing when it comes to my reading. I'll read anything. I read comics, graphic novels, kids' books, whatever I enjoy, that's what I'll read.
Good for you.
Yes, it feels really good. The problem that I do run into, though, is I will chase the number, which is arbitrary and self-imposed and often just anxiety-inducing, honestly. How do you feel about reading challenges? Whether it's sort of, you know, the garden variety Goodreads challenge of predicting how many books you're going to read in a year, or doing a specific genre challenge. Do you find them motivational, as many people do, or more anxiety-inducing?
I mean, I find so few things other than praise from strangers motivational. that I can't say that I'm like a strictly great example, but no, I don't find them motivational. And I think it is very easy for them to be an anxiety production machine. And because it's so easy to fall behind, and because, you know, everyone's reading rhythms are so different, that I think once you've fallen behind, it's very easy to feel like you're failing. And then I think for a lot of adults, it's very hard to do things again and again. It feels like you're failing at, because we've all aged into a point where, like, we've built our basic core competencies and we've designed our lives around using mostly only those basic core competencies. And acquiring new skills is therefore very weird and scary. And there's like a lot of pride that comes into it. And so I think, you know yourself best. If you know yourself to be really responsive to like data and numbers, if there's some way you can visualize how much you've read, that's just going to give you this deep sense of satisfaction that's going to be motivating, go for it. But I think for a lot of people, that's just the easiest thing to hand. And so it's what they turn to, but it's not actually what benefits their experience of reading best. And if you are a data person, but number of books isn't something that's easy to attain, maybe habit of reading would be a better thing to track. You know, how many days in a row have you made time to read something you're really excited about reading? And one thing that I recommend is really building a very sort of conscious ritual around it. At least this is what works for me. And having it be a time when you unplug, because that's one really, really good thing about books. And this is true even of ebooks, if you set up your device appropriately, is they don't come with push notifications. It is surrendering to this external experience. And if you can put away your disruptive things, it can be this very wholly engrossing experience. And everything that you make of a book comes from inside of you, right? There's nothing external to your experience that's generating the world that you have with you. You know, it's just your imagination and the words and your frame of reference and the characters. And so you can have this quieter, restorative experience that I think all of us really hunger for, especially in this wonderful time of everything all at once, as much as possible forever, no natural boundaries to day, night, weekend, weekday, work, not work, parenting, work. Everything's just one big gray mess.
Right.
So I think we're all seeking these meditative experiences a little bit more. And I think reading a book you really are engaged with is a great way to have one.
Yeah. Yeah. When it comes to a ritual, myself, like I imagine many other people, it was already built into their commute. I read on the subway, and that was just inherent to my day. And it was really easy to keep, because what else are you doing on the A train? Right. But that was the before times. Now it's, I find myself having a hard time finding, I have to put a lot more thought into it since it's not a habit. It's not sort of built into my day. My commute doesn't exist anymore. So whenever you have to establish, in this shift of habit, have you been able to establish, when have you had to establish sort of a new, I guess, schedule for reading? Or what recommendations would you have for people who have to shift from what their previous schedule was or what their previous habit in regard to what they were reading was to something completely new and unfamiliar?
Well, I think what is important to do is to look at the habits that you had from before that were externally imposed and figure out which ones of those were actually really good and welcome. And then, you know, if you figure out, well, what was really good and welcome is I spent this time every morning reading and I didn't have to choose to do it. It was imposed on my schedule, but that time was so important that now I need to decide to choose to include it. And then, you know, you got to start thinking about how does it make sense to go about doing that? So if you've got portions of the world you can access right now that are not necessarily your common spaces, I think pairing reading with one of those places you'd like to spend more time would be great. Obviously, that's really tricky. I don't know. Are you two both in New York?
Mm-hmm.
My my most sincere condolences to you for being trapped in your apartments in a city no one moves to for their apartment.
Right.
Right.
Exactly. So I don't know what kind of spaces you guys have access to, but if there's a fire escape and you don't necessarily spend that much time out there, if there is a park that's in walking distance, if there's just like a window with a particularly nice view that you're not taking advantage of as regularly because it's not by your work desk, building your practice around multiple rewards simultaneously, I think makes it easier to maintain.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
I mean, I'm really struck listening to you thinking about that we should associate reading with pleasure. I think people just don't. They just get into this like, well, it's good for me. It's like eating your vegetables and exercising. We've taken the pleasure out of all of these things. And it's just another thing on your list you've got to do because it's good for me. And I find for myself, if somebody tells me I have to do something, I don't want to do it. The minute, like I have to read a book for work,
absolutely.
I don't want to do it.
I am the worst book club member for exactly this reason. Because the second exactly. they're like, well, we're all reading Big Little Lies next month. And like, you're not my mom.
Yeah.
I'm going to read what I want. Which is why I've made it, I think, some percentage of the way through Infinite Jest 3 times. I think my deepest pull was 476 pages because it's my older brother's favorite book. And he gave me a signed copy for my college graduation. And like, I want to honor that interest of his. But my God, so many footnotes. Yeah. And
there's so much pressure there. If someone loves something so much and they recommend it, what if you don't like
God,
it?
Yes.
What if you don't finish it? What if you disagree with them? What if you don't meet their expectation? I find that so anxiety.
Terrifying.
If someone loves something so much and they're like, here, you'll love it too.
Absolutely. I think this is also a very important thing to sort of assess about yourself is are recommendations a really good motivator for you or are they a demotivator? For me, they're a demotivator. I love to make a recommendation. I hate to take a recommendation. And I don't think I hate it. You know, like I love knowing what my friends love and I want to enjoy it with them. But I do have that pressure trap that comes on where it's like, well, what if I don't love this book the same way my friend does? You know, what does that look like for us? And so, you know, my poor friend Carrie, I have her copy of Lincoln and the Bardot on my bookcase back there. Been meaning to read it for, boy, sometime now, surely sometime. And I'm definitely going to because I trust her taste, but it's a different thing. And that's why I think it can be really important to find recommenders who are reliable, but to whom you do not feel beholden, right? And so like a key part of my reading life is a bookshop here in the greater Boston area where I grew up called literally the Children's Bookshop. And the woman who owns it, Terry Schmidt, is a genius. And she's just like such an incredible example of rigorous engagement as a metric for devotion. And so she loves children's books, but she doesn't love them in a sort of like soft Hallmark greeting card sort of way. She loves them with like a sharp, critical, assessing mind. And I've been going to that bookshop since I was 7. And she has a very fully developed understanding of my taste. And, you know, I would be like 14 and I'd go into that shop and she'd be like, Margaret, I have no idea who this book is for except you, which was a certain slant of light by a woman named Laura Whitcomb. And it's fantastic. And that's great because I know I can go into that shop anytime I want to and Terry will know exactly what I should read next. But then I also leave that shop. And unless I elect to come back and say to Terry, boy, thank you for giving me a certain slant of light. That was exactly what I wanted to read. Thank you so much. She'll never know. She'll never be hurt by it. I'm not going to have awkward dinner party conversations with her. It's a purely elective thing. And what's also important about professional recommenders, which is something I would consider myself, is that professional recommenders decenter their own taste and they work to understand yours. So I hate the question, which is often how people start a recommendation-seeking conversation with me. What's the best book you've read lately? And it's like, well, I can tell you. But the best book for me, there's no guarantee it's going to be the best book for you. So what I will counter with is I'm like, well, what's one book you wish you could read again for the first time? What's one book where you had this transcendent experience and you're just chasing that dragon for the rest of time? Let me find you a book that's going to match that, which is actually where like my most successful book recommendation has ever originated. So like many bookish brunettes of a certain age, I love The Westing Game by Ellen Raskin. And it's one of those ones that won the Newbery at like a key moment. And so it never goes out of print. And 11-year-olds all across the country find it and are delighted by the sort of puzzle box mystery it presents. And I know a lot of people are still chasing that dragon. And I happen to have found exactly the book that is that dragon for them, but for adults. And it's called Bellwether Rhapsody by Kate Reculia. It's fantastic. And it works in the palette of The Westing Game. And it's just so fun and propulsive and enjoyable.
We actually discussed The Westing Game on a previous episode of The Upgrade. This was like a couple of years ago. Our former editor-in-chief brought it up as like the book that changed everything for her, to change her life. And I had never heard of it. I somehow just like missed it. So I read it and I loved it. And I think that's a big part that people don't respect is like middle grade novels, young adult novels. These are all fair game. We should be enjoying them because they're some of the best writing out
there. Absolutely. And another thing that's really nice about that is they are paced so much in a much more friendly way, right? They're paced for the readers who are age appropriate for them. They move through them at the same pace that we would move through really dense literary fiction sometimes. And for readers like us, you can actually move through it at a clip that fits your 25-minute commute. I would also encourage people to think of audiobooks as reading. I think a lot of people are like, oh, if I've listened to a book, I haven't read it. And they are different processing experiences, but they are not, neither one is more or less valid than the other. And I find audiobooks to be just like a much easier thing to fit into my schedule because I can clean my room and put on an audiobook. I can go for a walk with an audiobook. And so especially right now, when carving out time for yourself is so hard, that can be a really good way of finding new writers. And I would say, I know rereading is tough because you don't want to devote this limited time to covering ground you've already covered. You want to find new things. But that's one thing I found really helpful to do through audiobook. And that way, what a lot of people say is they have a hard time with it because they'll sort of tune out. Because until you build the habit, it's kind of tough. Which is why it's great to start with rereading, because if you miss a sentence, but you already know the story, you're not having the same degraded experience of the narrative that you would have if it's brand new to you. And then once you've built the habit, you can branch out. And there are always going to be some writers who are not really well suited to that. I dearly, dearly love George Eliot, but the woman's sentences are even longer and more undiagrammable than mine, which is impressive because mine are lengthy and full of clauses. and it's so easy to just like, you're just like chasing that snake and then it's a circle and then you're hypnotized and you're like, I have no idea what just happened with Dorothea Brooke. Maybe your mileage may vary, listeners, but if a thing is not working for you, also, feel free to abandon it. You know, your experience of reading is subjective. It is a conversation between you and the book. And saying, you know, I've tried Infinite Jest 3 times. I've not made it through yet. I'm still confident I'm going to read it someday. I just have to find the right time, the right mood, the right me to meet that book in its completion. And I haven't yet. And if you keep forcing it with a book you're not liking, it's not fair to you. It's also not fair to the book. You think you're doing the book a favor by not abandoning it. But if you're not in the right headspace to enjoy it, you are hurting that book's chances of getting its hooks into you in the future. So no matter how many people have told you My Brilliant Friend by Elena Ferrante is the greatest book of all time, no matter how much you would like to be inside that opinion with them, if you're trying it and it's not grabbing you, it is a kindness to you and a kindness to Elena to set it aside and say, I'll try that again another time. I'm going to find something that really clicks with me right now.
Do you have a threshold for abandonment or a recommendation for when to know that, like, this isn't for me, I'm going to put this down and I'm going to come back to it later, or this isn't for me, I'm going to put this down and never come back to it again?
Never come back to it again is usually pretty easy. Like, if a book is making me mad, I don't have to read that. There's so many books. Sometimes I will, just for the joy of being as informedly furious as I possibly can be, which is how I finished The Marriage Plot by Jeffrey Eugenides, probably my least favorite book of all time. That, if a book's making you mad and you don't have a piercing need to document the accuracy of that fury, put it down, let it go, set it free, put it in one of those little free little libraries and let it find a good home with someone who's meant to love it. And then in terms of like put it down, if you are finding yourself not making any progress in a book and you're trying to pick it up and you're like, you're just not feeling it, give yourself a chance to find one you are excited to open. And do that by talking with a bookseller or a librarian or someone else who knows how to decenter their taste, help you identify the dragon you're chasing, and help you find it. And like, I don't know how many adults know this because it's not really something that we talk about as kids, but librarians are trained in a service called Reader's Advisory. And it's really like you can go in and you can be like, I love Inception. What's a book that's going to be like the movie Inception? And librarians will know. And it doesn't matter if they hate Inception. They're still, we are trained to understand your taste, diagram it, and find it for you in different formats. And good booksellers have that same capacity as well. So that's a service that you can go in that's just the same as going in and asking a reference question. And I think it's one that users are not necessarily nearly as aware of. So my recommendation for you at home is investigate what your libraries have to offer. And it's very risk-free. You're not spending money on that book. You just get to grab as many as you want, and then you can pick whatever feels right.
Awesome.
Awesome. I love libraries. Margaret, thank you so much for joining us. This was really great.
Thank you guys so much for having me and letting me talk almost ceaselessly.
It's awesome. I love it.
This was amazing.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
And now our segment with Nancy Pearl. She'll tell us how we can seek out books that we'll really love.
Hi, my name is Nancy Pearl, and I'm a librarian, a writer, and most recently the author of the novel George and Lizzie. What I want to talk about today is how to find a book to read that's just like the book that you just finished reading and you really loved. The first thing that you have to do is identify what it was about the book that you really enjoyed. And this is identifying not what the book is about, but what it was about the book that you liked. And think about it in terms of these four options. And I'm going to talk about each one of these options. Number one, what if what you liked about the book was how fast moving it was, or how you couldn't wait to find out what happened next, or the pages kept turning of themselves and you stayed up way too late to finish the book? Then I think what you're looking for is a book that is really plot based, plot-driven. And one of the good places to find plot-driven books are mysteries, but not all mysteries are plot-driven. When you're talking about a plot-driven book, what you're talking about is a very fast-moving book. And the way to find a fast-moving book is to go to a section like the regular fiction department of a bookstore or a library, or go to the mystery section and open up a book and see how much white space there is on the page. If there's a lot of white space on the page, what that means is that this book is going to move along really quickly, because a lot of white space on the page indicates a lot of conversation. And when there's a lot of conversation, everything moves along lickety-split. Another way of thinking about plot-driven books, which really are some of the most popular books that are being published, are what we would call airplane reads, books that you can find very prominently displayed in airport bookstores. The Da Vinci Code is a good example of that. The thrillers by Lee Child are a very good example of that. But let's say that what you really are looking for, that the book you loved, you felt about the book like you really knew the characters, like they became, while you were reading, your best friends, that they felt like, as we said in English classes, they were really three-dimensional and well-rounded characters. What you're looking for in that case is a book that's character-based, that's character-driven. If you're looking for a character-driven book, there are two places that you can look for in the bookstore or the library. One of them is the fiction section. And in the fiction section, look for books in which the title is the name of characters, or the title is descriptive of characters. For example, my novel, George and Lizzie, is very character-driven. It's really about two people, and you learn about them, and hopefully you'll grow to love them, as I did. But I called the book George and Lizzie to alert people to the fact that it was a character-driven book. Nick Hornby's novel, About a Boy, is another really good example of character-driven novel. Ruth Doan McDougall's novel, The Cheerleader, is a wonderful character-driven novel. Anne Tyler's novel, The Accidental Tourist. So what you're looking for is books that describe characters, and that will help you find a character-driven novel. Another place to look for character-driven books, although not novels, is to look in the memoir section or the biography section. Those books are, by definition, about characters, about people. Now, the third type of book that you might be looking for is a book that really emphasizes place. And you know, I never thought that place was really important in thinking about why people liked the books they liked. And then I worked with a woman who would come in to work every day, and I would say, "Oh, Martha, what are you reading?" And before she would tell me the name of the book, she would say, "Oh, Nancy, I feel like I'm there." And it's that there-ness that really marks a book that is place-driven, that is emphasized by place. It's the kind of book that you feel like you could go to that place and you know it. You could walk its streets. And there are two types of books that really depend on place to make the book satisfying to readers. And one of those is historical fiction, and the other is science fiction and fantasy. With both of those, what makes those books successful as novels and what makes readers love them is that those authors are really good at world building, that they can make an unfamiliar place or an unfamiliar time come alive for the reader. Now, a couple of suggestions of those books are, for example, the C.S. Lewis Narnia books. Just the fact that we call them Narnia books is indicative of how important place is. Patrick Rothfuss, another wonderful fantasy writer, has developed a whole world. The last type of book that people love is books in which what we might term as well-written books, books in which the quality of the prose is really important. And when you think about those books, what your experience of reading them is that you have to stop reading every page or so because you're too busy underlining passages that you want to read to somebody. Or it's the kind of book that the language is so beautiful, so meaningful to you that you just want to hug the book. My own experience is I copy down passages from books that are really wonderfully written to save in a notebook. The only people who are going to describe a book as well written are people whose primary interest is in finding books in which the language really excites them, really delights them. And the way to find a book in which prose is really the primary characteristic is to look for books that have won major literary awards, like the Pulitzer Prize, like the National Book Award, like the National Book Critics Circle Award, and not just American writers, but look at the Canadian award winners, look at the Australian award winners, look at the Man Booker Prize that comes out of England. And those books are going to have one thing in common, not what the book is about, but the prose is going to be outstanding. So every book, every work of fiction and all literary nonfiction, nonfiction that tells a story, for example, has all four of these qualities. And really the difference from one book to another is not what the book is about, but it's how big each of these qualities are in a particular book. And so I hope that these hints will help you find your next good book.
So now it's time for our upgrade of the week. Every week we talk about that one tiny thing making a big difference in our lives. Margaret, what's your upgrade this week?
So I have, and this is no surprise to people accustomed to hearing me on Pop Culture Happy Hour, two upgrades, but they all fall under one umbrella, which is how to survive a pandemic when you are an extrovert. I am so, so starved for conversation with strangers, which I know to most people on the internet is a very weird thing, because the internet is home to cat people and introverts. But I assume some people listening to this might also be starved for outside communication. And what I'm going to recommend for you are two methods for it. One, phone banking. Obviously, it's hard work, but it is both a great way to feel like you're moving the needle forward in a world that is messy and scary. If you can find a candidate that you are really excited about and do some phone banking for them. And then also, just a great way to talk with some strangers. I'm in Boston, and so I'm doing phone banking for Ed Markey because he's a great senator, and I would really like him to stay in the Senate and keep advancing things like the Green New Deal. So I've been phone banking for him, and that's really nice because I'm talking to my neighbors and other like-minded voters in this area, and we just chat, and it's fantastic. So that's one thing that I would recommend. Do some phone banking if you're an extrovert starved for outside interaction. And then the other thing is on my Instagram, sort of I fell into this habit of running music surveys, where on Sundays I throw out a prompt and anybody who wants to can respond with a song that they think fits it. And so like for Juneteenth, I did like, what's your favorite song about Black Joy? And for Father's Day and Mother's Day, I did a song you love now that you got from your mom or your dad. And I had people send in pictures of their parents with that. And that has been an incredible source of serendipitous discovery for me, which is something I really, really value. And like I say, it's so much harder to find in the world as it is presently constructed. And so I've found like dozens of artists, either ones with huge back catalogs or ones that are brand new on the scene that I am so excited to listen to and spend time with. And I'm somebody who goes to a lot of concerts in real life. Music is a big axis of excitement for me. And being as closed out from that scene as I have been has been really hard. And this has been a super, super great way to get back into that. So I would say find ways to model that in your own life. And if it sounds fun, come find me on Instagram. I'm Mrs. Friday Next on Instagram, and play along with me. I take all the prompts. On Sundays and Mondays, I sort of share highlights. And then later in the week, I put everything into a Spotify playlist that people can subscribe to so that they can listen to and spend time with it on their own. And you can see, I think I'm on my 11th playlist now. So you can see the 11 playlists that have happened so far. And some of them are just really, really fun. So those are my upgrades.
Oh, I love it. That's so great. Those are good upgrades. I think I'm somewhere in between extrovert and introvert.
Most people are.
Depends on the day. And I definitely find myself missing those little interactions of, you know, talking to a cashier at a coffee shop or talking to somebody when I'm walking my dog. And, you know, that kind of stuff is really, it's gone.
Yeah. And I think we all suffer when our little interactions are happening exclusively on the internet, because much like all good people are the worst person they're ever going to be at 14. All good people are the worst version of themselves from time to time on the internet. And so, you know, like the rage that would normally just dissipate when like someone tried to get on the subway before everyone else had left the car, which is truly just, I don't think my aggression spikes any higher than in that moment. In fact, I know it doesn't, because one time when I'm sleep deprived, it's just like my impulse control really goes down. And one morning, I think I'd gotten like 3 hours of sleep and I was waiting on the T platform and someone started trying to go into the train before everyone else had got on. And I grabbed a hold of the backpack and I held it and it just said, no. And I was like, I looked at my hand like it had moved of its own volition, which it felt like it had. And I would just say that like annoying replies on Twitter are where all of that energy goes now. And we're all so socially starved that we're on those places more often and everyone is behaving worse on them as a result because we're socially starved. So I would say stepping away from the morass of online interaction is wise, but building like a bonfire, like a campfire for people who are more like you to come and sit around is a much better way to be in those spaces. So that's what I've been doing. And it's been very helpful for me.
Oh my God, you gave me so many ideas. That's great. Thank you so much. Jordan.
My pleasure.
Jordan, what's your upgrade?
Two of the problems that I've faced in the pandemic have been solved with one little time hack that I've slowly discovered for myself. So I was trying to figure out, like I mentioned earlier, when to read now that my commute has been taken away. And previously, obviously I would be reading on the train. And when the pandemic started, I would read before bed, but I would find myself falling asleep and then having to reread the last pages that I read. It wasn't the most efficient thing, falling asleep while reading and then having to reread the chapter because I don't remember anything. Another thing that I used to do as well in the mornings was meditate. And now, as a way to break up my day, I've combined those two things where sometime around lunch, since I don't really take lunch anymore, I just sort of eat throughout the day, I meditate and then I read. And I do them right in the middle of the day. And it's become sort of my delineator between the morning and the afternoon, or the, you know, what I plan on doing the first half of the day versus what I plan on doing the second half of the day. So I'll take 10, 15 minutes to meditate using Headspace, and then I'll stay in that spot and read for about half an hour.
That's great.
So smart.
Yeah. It's so hard to find things to kind of delineate your times. Everything just turns into this mush. Everything's just the same all the time.
Life is just oatmeal.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this has been my way of breaking up my day in a really sort of calming, structured, resetting type of way.
That's so smart.
Nice.
Alice, what's your upgrade this week?
So my pandemic situation, something that's gotten worse since the pandemic, is just my body. It's like I don't move as much as I used to, and I don't get up from my desk all day, and I've become like so tense, like muscles that I didn't even know I have are spasming. I'm just like hobbling around when I wake up in the morning. I'm very tense. So something I discovered is I already had a foam roller, but it didn't do very much. It didn't feel like it was doing enough, although it can still be like super painful, right? I don't know. It's just like I was just torturing myself.
I love
myself.
Things that are super painful but still don't feel like they're doing enough.
Exactly.
Like most of my relationships.
Just rolling, going, ow, ow, and then I'm exactly the same. But I discovered these therapy balls, which I'm going to show you. They're different sizes. But you can really target like those points that are spasming with these by like lying down over them or leaning against a wall. And there's a lot of YouTube videos that tell you how to use them. They're called Therapy Ball Plus is this one. Anyway, I'm using them now like 5 minutes a day and it's great. I'm actually feeling looser and more able to, you know, move like a human. So yeah, can't recommend enough.
Love those. Love those. Also love if you're sitting down, just rolling your feet on them during
yes.
the day. A plus.
Well, Margaret, thank you so much. This was so great.
Thank you guys so much for having me on. I had a really good time.
And that's our show. The Upgrade is produced by Michaela Heck and mixed by Jamie Collazo.
Please rate us on Apple Podcasts and leave us a review. We'd love to read them and we'd love to hear from you. You can also reach us by calling us at 347-687-8109 and leaving a voicemail. Or you can write to us at upgrade@lifehacker.com.
You can also find us on Twitter at Lifehacker, on Instagram at lifehacker.com, all one word, and on Facebook at facebook.com/lifehacker. Sign up for Lifehacker's daily newsletter full of tips and tricks and hacks at lifehacker.com/newsletter. And you can find show notes for this and every episode of The Upgrade at lifehacker.com/the show.